I have only been to Hong Kong once, a few years ago, to do the literature festival. And I was initially quite surprised. I've been told that it was totally built up, but when you drive into it from the airport, you see there is actually quite a lot of countryside on the way in, rather pretty countryside. I was surprised by how little old architecture there was. Everything seems very bright and modern. But on the other hand, it seems to be a sort of a nice, clean, interesting, bustling place full of pleasant people. So I enjoyed it. And I loved Stanley Market. I got velvet jackets for me and the two children, so we match. And I got my son a bright yellow jacket, so which he calls his emperor jacket. Book fairs vary tremendously from country to country. You don't usually know what to expect. For example, in France, they have things called Salon de Livre, where writers and intellectuals turn up and talk pretentiously on television at immense length. And then you get festivals in other places which are sort of run by volunteers and you're staying with a local. You don't really know what to expect. So in this case, I don't really know what to expect. It'll probably be a surprise to me, whatever it is. I use personal experience only up to a point. If you exploit your personal experience too much, you end up with no material. I have a friend in Canada to whom this happened. She just mined her own life until there was nothing left to write about. She rang me up desperately saying, "How do you do it?" That the point is to use other people's experience, really. If somebody tells me a good story, I just say, "Can I have it?" I got my best ghost story like that. And I did an event in Norwich the other night where somebody told me a story before I did the event, and I said, "Can I have that?" I'm very keen on interviewing people to get their experiences. So, for example, there came a point when I was writing my third novel when I wanted to know what it was like to go into battle. So I made my father sit down in the dining room and I interviewed him. Old soldiers don't like to talk about that kind of thing very much unless you specifically ask them. So I rely mostly, I would say, on other people's experience. I'm not so much a hoover for other people's feelings and thoughts as a hoover for good stories. I think most of what I do is driven by narrative rather than character, although that's something I'm trying to change at the moment. The novel I'm doing at present is, I think, mostly character-driven. So they determine the story rather than the story determining what happens to them. But the thing is, when you're doing research for a novel or for a short story or whatever, you often come up with far more interesting things than anything you could have made up. Somebody did once forbid me to tell a story, which was a shame. I thought it was extremely interesting. And as this is going out in Hong Kong, it won't really matter telling you what it is. But somebody told me that she had had, she was having a love affair with somebody and then sort of fell in love with his best friend at the same time. And so this dreadful situation arose where she didn't know what to do. And she fled abroad for a while to try and sort herself out. And when she came back, she found that they'd done a deal that neither of them could have her. And I've also thought this would be the most astounding, a really good story for a novella. But she wouldn't let me use it, but I think I'm going to anyway. The truth about the mandolin is that I'm really more of a classical guitar player. It was always my first love, classical guitar. Or to be more accurate, I was a folk guitarist who became a classical guitar player. But everyone who plays the guitar dabbles with the mandolin sooner or later. And in fact, it's tuned the same as a violin, so anyone who plays the violin ought to be able to play the mandolin. But when I was writing Captain Crowley's Mandolin, I already had a mandolin, and I just started diddling with it more and more to get myself in the mood or to see what it was like playing certain pieces. I wanted to get it right. And after I had finished the book, I continued playing the mandolin a great deal for a great many years. I don't play it quite so much now because I find that holding a pick gives me terrible cramps in my right hand. But I still love it. I still have an ambition to be better at it than I am. If I was writing a book about a classical guitarist, I would be playing classical guitar all the time, and that would improve the narrative and simultaneously improve my classical guitar playing. It's one of the pleasures of writing is that you can become good at or knowledgeable about things which you otherwise wouldn't have bothered with. I've had to become a good historian to be a novelist. If you write mainly stories set in the past, you've got to find out ways of researching what you do. And it doesn't actually involve going to libraries or trawling the internet. It mostly involves going places and collecting stories, picking up the atmosphere, learning what they eat and what it feels like to be in that kind of temperature. I never would have got interested in Turkey, for example, if I hadn't come up with a story quite accidentally when I was there on a holiday. The story I'm referring to is Birds Without Wings, where I came across a deserted, ruined town in southwest Turkey, which was a minor tourist attraction, which used to have a large Christian population who were expelled after the war between Greece and Turkey, which was, in the early 1920s. They did a population exchange. They thought that if the Christians from Turkey were sent to Greece, even if they didn't speak Greek, and if the Muslims from Greece were sent to Turkey, even if they didn't speak Turkish, then that would somehow sort out their problems. It was a solution imposed on them by the Allies, Britain, France, Italy, America. And it was done really without thought to the consequences to the people involved. Some of them had to march hundreds of miles with no supplies, you know. But I wouldn't have found out about all that kind of thing unless I had discovered this little town where there were, in a Muslim country, which had lots of Christian chapels and ruined churches. I went to South America when I was 18. I went to Colombia. I got a job on a ranch right out in the middle of nowhere in the countryside. It was guerrilla country. You know, FARC were operating there, so I had to learn to use a revolver straight away. And it was exactly the right age to go and spend a year in rural Colombia. If I did it now, it wouldn't have nearly such a big effect. But I was obviously much more impressionable and open-minded then than I am now. And it's really opened my eyes to the different ways in which you can live. The people there had almost nothing. Their society was extremely violent and very drunken, but they were mostly pretty happy and their food grew on trees. So their worries were relatively few. And they were quite openly obsessed with bodily functions in a way that would make Westerners quite surprised, because we think we're all kind of open and liberal, but we're not compared to them. And, so when I came back from Colombia, I went and did my degree at Manchester, which was in those days, in the mid-70s, was utterly grim. You know, everything was broken, everything was filthy, everyone was depressed, it rained all the time every day. And the only way I could stay sane was by staying in Colombia in my mind. And for years and years afterwards, I only read literature from Latin America. And I feel that we are a bit like computers, which is you tend to get out what you put in. This is why computer modelling is hopeless for science. So because I was reading so much Latin American literature, when I started writing, it naturally came out in that style. And then after three novels, I'd had enough of that and wanted to move on. I was utterly enthused by it. Magic realism was in vogue at the time, and that completely liberated the narrative, and anything could happen. That's wonderful to begin with, but after a while you do get fed up with it and you want something a bit more structure and discipline. And I don't do magic realism at all now, but it is what started me off. And I also loved the political realism. And however crazy the stories were, if you knew the historical background, they made sense. And the other thing I enjoyed was the exuberant style that most of those writers had. They were clearly in love with language. They would use words that rolled off the tongue in Spanish, many of which you can do straight into English. So Marquez, for example, loves the word prodigioso, which is in English prodigious. So you'll find me using words which I've inherited from those Latin Americans rather than from our own rather more terse tradition. Yeah, I did say, apropos of films, that it would be impossible for an author to be happy about its baby's ears being put on backwards. But I didn't specifically say that about the film of Captain Corelli's Mandolin. There were things that I thought could have been a lot better. For example, there's a completely spurious sex scene in the middle, And a part of the tragedy of the book, or the sadness of the book, was that they did not become lovers when they were young. You know, they missed their opportunity. I thought that rather spoilt the trajectory of the story. And there were some lines in the script which I wouldn't have written if you had been stamping on my face at the time. I mean, like, I realised I couldn't live without you. It's just the most appalling line, which must have been in every bad film for the last century. So, but the scene where the young Italian soldiers were massacred is absolutely brilliant. They did it in the place where it happened and in the manner that it happened. It was heart-wrenching. I thought the whole film was worth it just for that one scene. Because you had got fond of those boys. And then they just wiped out. That's the whole point. So they got the point there. The other thing is that the cinematography was perfect. It was every frame was like was classically composed. And lastly, the soundtrack was brilliant. Stephen Warbeck's soundtrack. There's at least one song there which is going to last forever. You know, Ricordo Ancora, which you still hear regularly on Classic FM. So I wasn't as utterly displeased with the film as people thought. But in any case, my attitude is that it's a bit like losing your virginity. That you it might not be such a great experience, but it doesn't stop you having another go. There are several problems involved with filmmaking. One is that films are made by committees, and they all stick their oar in and interfere and want to have their own way, especially if they put any money in, which is why American producers always want a happy ending, which I actually find rather depressing, rather a miserable one any day. So it's a film is never or hardly ever the result of one person's genius, whereas a novel is the result of one person's genius. It has a unity about it, which you can't get in a film. The other thing is that films necessarily, because they're only a couple of hours long, miss out all of the interesting detail that make a novel rich. That's why it's often said that the best material for a film is actually a novella. And I did write a novella for children, actually. It was called Red Dog. And it was made into a film in Australia, which is just absolutely perfect. You know, there are one or two places where it's a bit sentimental, but it gets away with it. And I was completely pleased with that film. If you had filmed Captain Corelli, you know, exactly as I wrote it, it would have been several days long. The novel I have all but finished is in some ways similar to what I've done before. I'm interested in the various types of love. I mean, so when I was writing Captain Corelli's Mandolin and Birds Without Wings, I was interested in the love between friends, the love between parents and children, the love between brothers and sisters, as well as in romantic love, or the love of people who've been married a long time. So I'm interested in all these varieties of love, and I've tried to do that in the novel that I'm doing now. So there's a father who has a nice relationship with his daughters. There's a lesbian love affair, which is something I've never done before, because it's set in the 1920s, in the 1920s. I tried to do it in a 1920s sort of way. There are no explicit sex scenes, for example. And it opens with the love between a young woman whose fiancé is just going off to war, about their vows of eternal love, etc. And then he's killed a few weeks later. And then later on, she makes a marriage. She marries somebody, probably for the wrong reasons. And much of the story is about how they learn to accommodate to each other. So the novel ends with them making a new start in Ceylon, I hope fairly happily. There are lots of different kinds of love, and I think they should all be written about. I think writers are a bit like people at war, that they do have superstitions about what will keep them safe and what will keep things working. Like, you know, you've got to have your blue bar over there and your mouse on the left-hand side and not on the right-hand side. All these writers do have those kinds of rituals and things, strange obsessions, but I'm afraid I don't. I just adore writing. I love doing it. And if I don't do it often enough, I start to get very bad-tempered. I need to do it to stay normal. I suppose I need my I need my time of being completely immersed in fairyland. I think of it as a form of controlled and rather useful insanity. But the actual process involves an idea niggling at me until I can no longer resist writing it down. And it can niggle at me for ages. The book I'm writing now I've been thinking about for 20 years. And I finally got down to it in a big way about, well, 2 or 3 years ago, after my last collection of short stories was published. It was a long niggle, 20 years, but A Partisan's Daughter went through 7 versions, the first of which I wrote in my mid-20s. So, I think you're perfectly safe if you write several things at once, which is what I do. If I'm in the middle of writing a novel and a good short story occurs to me, I won't put it off. I'll write it straight away while it's still a fresh idea in my mind. And in that way, you do accumulate a very large amount of material almost accidentally. I don't know how much my editors love me, because there are long periods when they think I'm doing absolutely nothing and they're in despair. And then I produce an absolutely enormous novel. And that is particularly distressing to my Greek editor, because Greek takes up twice as much space as English. So a big book in English is a positively colossal one in Greek. My first collection of poetry is indeed coming out in August. The book is themed in a way because they are poems inspired by my favourite Greek poet, who was Konstantin Kavafis, who lived in Alexandria. And he was obsessed with erotic love, in his case gay love, the ancient world, and several poems in which he liked to philosophise. And I'm interested in all of these things. So, because I always travel with Kavafis in my pocket, I tend to write Kavafis-type poems quite a lot. 5 of these poems I wrote when I was last in Hong Kong, because I read the whole volumes through something like twice on the journey over in the aeroplane. And when I got to my hotel, I was in such an altered state of mind because of the time lag and the alcohol and all that, I wrote 5 Kavafis poems straight off. So this is a collection of my Kavafis poems. And I have 2 other anthologies which are ready to publish as well, which I will do at a later date, publishers permitting. I wouldn't say this is an homage to Greek poetry. It's an homage to Kavafis in particular. He was an unusual poet, even by Greek standards. He had a particular style which was very stripped down. It was almost prose, people used to say. And he wrote in an odd mixture of slangy Greek, Demotic Greek, and very posh Kathravousa Greek. And there were complicated rhymes and rhythms which you can't duplicate in English. There's no point. My Greek isn't good enough to appreciate that at all. You will notice that Greek poets in general very, very often write about the ancient world or have references to the ancient world. Yanis Ritsos is a good example. He does. You'll find that he's writing a poem which is basically a communist one, but he's referring to Odysseus, things like that. But Kavafis is a unique poetic voice. I don't think there's anyone else like him. I wrote these poems without much of a sense of audience, except for the Greeks I know who love Kavafis. Kavafis is fairly well known and fairly well loved in the English speaking world as well. He did live in Liverpool for some time, and his poems are very easily translated into English. It's terribly natural. You don't lose much in the translation. So he does have a lot of English and British admirers, and American ones too. But I wasn't really thinking of a particular audience, and I was originally thinking I wouldn't be able to publish them at all. I was shy about asking my own publisher if he would do it. And I know I'm going to come into some bother for them not being as good as Kavafis. That's obvious. But on the other hand, I have had a nice little bit of praise from one Greek reader who'd said that when he died, Kavafis still had 25 poems left to write, and that I had written at least one of them. That's a nice compliment, yes. I know nothing about the Hong Kong literary scene other than what I found out last time I was there, which was really very little. I read the Asia Literary Review, which of course isn't or wasn't just about Hong Kong. It's about all of Asia, isn't it? So, no, I have no preconceptions about it. I don't know what I'm going to find. But I suspect that what will happen is what always happens when you go abroad, which is you discover that there are dozens of really good writers that you've never read and will probably never have time to read. You would need several lifetimes to read everything that was worth reading from all over the world. So it can actually make you feel a little bit sad. I usually read three books at once. I read a book in my office after breakfast before I get to work and do my emails and so on. There's a book I read in the bath, which is usually fiction, but at the moment I'm reading philosophy. I mean, that was my degree, philosophy, and I'm still very interested in it. I'm catching up on all the great 19th century philosophers that no one else bothers with anymore. After lunch, I normally read something else, usually to do with research on whatever I'm writing. So I get an awful lot of reading done. I have thousands of books, and I think I've probably read most of them. But with novels, I usually read what, for the same reason as other people do, which is that somebody said, hey, have you read this? It's really good. You must read that. So my little sister is a good reader. She will find something and tell me about it, and I'll read it if my little sister likes it. My mother was the same. As soon as I became published, my mother decided she had to be au fait with modern literature, and she started reading voraciously. She was reading all these people that I didn't read or didn't want to read and telling me what I ought to be reading. And she's gone now, sadly, but she was a good influence. I find with children that your favourite one changes all the time, doesn't it? Because it depends on their behaviour. Books don't behave in any way whatsoever, and so I can be more faithful to a book. I mean, I do believe that my best book is Birds Without Wings. I don't think I'll ever write anything better than that. And when I finished it, I thought, well, you know, it doesn't matter if I die now.
Really?
Well, I thought I'd done what I came here to do, and anything else is extra. Well, you see, Captain Corelli's Mandolin was my first attempt at War and Peace, and I didn't quite pull it off. And I felt that with Birds Without Wings, I had pulled it off. And in Turkey, they are referring to it as their War and Peace, and they're using it to teach Ottoman history at the universities. So I think, although it may not be appreciated here, you know, or in Britain, say, or in France as another War and Peace, it certainly is in the country which it depicts. And I find that really satisfying. Many people want to be writers without actually having to do any writing. It's like people want to be famous without having to do anything specific. It's a modern sickness. And what I say to people is, it's all very well wanting to be a writer, but what do you want to write? And secondly, more importantly perhaps, what are you good at writing? You have to find out what you're good at. You can't aspire to be Tolstoy if you're naturally P.D. James. You follow me? So it's no point aspiring to write thrillers if your natural talent is for erotica. So if I have ever done writing courses, I always try and spot what people are good at. And this is what Malcolm Bradbury did when he was at UEA. He didn't make anyone into a writer. What he did was find out what people were good at and then shove them along that path. You know, so I generally say to people, well, what kind of things do you like reading? Because those are the kinds of things you will probably be good at writing. Everybody has an autobiographical novel. But not everybody has real fiction in them. That is a specific form of insanity, which is a, you know, I think a privilege to be born with.